The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Before we get to our main event, it is now my pleasure to introduce a friend and supporter of the Free Library of Philadelphia, Michael A. Innocenzo, Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at PICO. He is a dedicated member of our Foundation Board of Directors, and with him, PICO has continued to be a key supporter of library programs like today's Leading Voices. Mike's role at PICO, Pennsylvania's largest electric and gas utility, is responsible for leadership of PICO's overall performance associated with operations, safety, service reliability, customer satisfaction, and financial management. In addition to serving on our board, he serves on the board of directors for the Philadelphia Police Athletic League and a youth basketball coach and volunteer for the St. Margaret's School Athletic Association. We are thrilled that Mike is here today to represent PICO and introduce today's guest speakers. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mike Innocenzo.
Thank you, Siobhan, and good morning.
Good morning.
I have to tell you, this is a great... You can't see what I can see, but we've got a great speaker, a great audience, and I've got our PICO crown lights right in the background. So this is just a phenomenal way for me to start my morning. So thank you. It really is a pleasure to be here this morning for the Library's Leading Voices series. Today's lecture is sponsored by PICO Smart Ideas, and we have a couple representatives for our PICO Smart Ideas program here. So if you do have some questions, please pull any of us aside. It's a great program. At PICO, we're delivering innovation, advancing smart energy to provide safe, reliable, affordable, and clean energy and energy services for our customers. PICO's Smart Ideas, our award-winning suite of energy efficiency programs, is part of this. In fact, our customers have saved more than $500 million over the last 2 years with PICO Smart Ideas. This is money customers can use to grow their businesses and invest in the local economy. Leading Voices inspires all of us to become leaders in the workplace and better people in our daily lives. Today's guest is no exception. Daniel Shapiro is one of the world's leading experts on negotiation and conflict resolution. He's made a career out of helping people navigate these critical conversations. As a founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program, Daniel has launched successful conflict resolution initiatives in the Middle East, Europe, and East Asia. He has served as chair of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Conflict Resolution and developed a conflict management program now reaching more than 1 million young people in more than 30 countries. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome our esteemed speaker, Daniel Shapiro.
Thank you, and good morning. How are you all doing this morning? Yes. So first of all, a huge thank you to the Free Library of Philadelphia for making this happen today. Special thank you as well to PICO. I think it's very fitting at 8 o'clock in the morning to have an energy producer sponsoring our event today. So I need it, and the other element is coffee. But anyway, so it is a tremendous honor to be here today with all of you. Let me start with just one simple question. A show of hands, how many of you in the past 6 months have experienced an emotionally charged conflict? How many of you?
6 hours.
And 6 hours, okay, good, okay, fair enough. Good. No, my sense is that, you know, almost every person considered a human being has experienced these kinds of conflicts and does experience them on a regular basis. The question is, how do you deal with them most effectively? And this is really where my research has taken me over the past 20, 25 years, both at the interpersonal levels, in the office, with your loved ones at home, and in the international sphere. How do you deal with these conflicts more effectively? But let me start with a somewhat different question now. Does anybody in this room know what a poplar tree is? A poplar tree. What's a poplar tree? Yes, what's a poplar? In just a sentence or two. You make it look like, well, obviously. Yes. Yeah. What's a poplar tree?
It's a deciduous tree I think the leaves shake in the wind.
This is enough. This is beautiful. Okay. So it's a deciduous tree. Its leaves do shake in the wind. And few of us in this room would have much concern at all for what is a poplar tree. If it weren't for the fact that there was a single poplar tree that sat right at that border between North and South Korea. And each year, this little deciduous tree would blossom, it would grow, and as it grew, its leaves would block the South Koreans' view of the Bridge of No Return, which was the conduit between North and South Korea. And so each year, out would march a small team of South Korean soldiers to trim this tree. And this was fine, year after year after year. Go out, they'd trim the tree, until August 6th, 1976, when that usual team of South Korean soldiers went out to trim the tree. They're trimming for about 10 minutes. Along comes a lieutenant from the North Korean side with a much larger team, North Korean soldiers, walks up to the lieutenant on the south. You try and trim this tree, we're going to shoot. We are going to shoot. And they literally chase away that South Korean team. But this was a security concern. It did not stop the South Koreans from trying to trim the tree. They come back about 2 weeks later, this time August 18th, 1976, now with a much larger team. South Korean soldiers, U.S. soldiers, U.N. officials, and all there with the single purpose of what? Of what? You're definitely mourning. I don't know. Tree something? They blow in the wind? Yes, of trying to trim the tree. So they're there once again, trying to trim this tree for security purposes. They're there for about 10 minutes. And as before, now from the north marches along a much larger team once again, North Korean soldiers. Lieutenant from the north marches up to lieutenant from the south. And once again, you try and trim this tree. We are going to shoot. We're going to shoot. And for those of you who might remember what happened next, this turned into a bloody, bloody mess. There were a number of South Koreans who were injured in this circumstance, North Koreans injured in this circumstance, two U.S. soldiers, not just shot, decapitated, caught on camera, broadcast around the world. And we've experienced this in different contexts here in the United States as well. And what happened there, just as a side note, I was presenting this case fairly recently at my home institution in Boston. After we were talking about the case with some international military leaders, some diplomats, business leaders, walking out of the room, this one gentleman, face as red as you can imagine, comes storming up to me. Shapiro, I don't think you understand. He says, I was there. I was at West Point, the U.S. military college at that point in time. He says, I knew those boys who died. I knew their families. We were not just feeling grief at the loss of our soldiers. He says we were feeling utter humiliation at the way our boys died. Surprise, surprise, the situation now reaches the highest of the high in the United States, the White House, where then President Ford was faced with a very difficult decision. What do you do? You know, and you are all leaders in this room, Philadelphia and beyond. What would you do? And he turns to his consigliere, the president turns to his consigliere, one of his key advisors. What do you think we should do? His advisor says, you know what I think we should do, Mr. President? I think we should bomb the North Koreans. And the president thinks about it and ultimately decides that a more appropriate strategy would be to simply try to cut down this tree, you know? So back to the scene now comes some 813 human power. You had F-4 fighters, F-5 fighters. You had a 64-man trained platoon. A 64-man platoon trained in Taekwondo. You had three B-52 bombers circling around overhead with the single purpose of what? Of what? Trying to chop down this tree, you know? And do they do it? Yes. How long does it take? About 1 hour? Was there further incident? No. But as I was learning about this situation, what struck me most is that this was literally almost World War III. I mean, literally almost World War III, and over what? Over a tree? And obviously, it's over much, much more than just a tree. But it begs two fundamental questions that we'll be talking about today. Questions that are just as relevant in the international sphere as they are in the sphere of our own home lives. Two big questions. One, why do we get so stuck in these emotionally charged conflicts? And two, how do we get out? And there's something strange about these emotionally charged conflicts. If this were the United States and Canada, and we had a problem with a tree at our border, you know, you and I would sit down for 5 minutes as fellow diplomats. We'd have this thing figured out. In Asia, this was almost World War III. What accounts for this? So that's what we're going to talk about today. Where do these ideas come from? One more point, just to give it more specific focus. Today, I'm going to talk about just some of the elements of the book you have in your hands of negotiating the non-negotiable. Two big things. The basis of a framework that we've been researching and building over many years now. What is the fundamental mindset that we found tends to just divide people in conflict situations, even when it is self-sabotaging, when it does not serve your own better good? And secondly, we've also discovered a set of emotional forces that tend to pull us toward this mindset, again, even if it is self-sabotaging. It does not serve our good. So briefly, where do these ideas come from? They come from a lot of places, but two big ones. One from laboratory research that myself and literally colleagues around the world have been doing. How do you deal with differences more effectively? And secondly, through practical work. So my own work, it's now been across the continents, working with everybody from civil society groups, working in the former Yugoslavia during the war there, to working with CEOs, business executives, heads of state. It's really been across the board. And learning from all of those experiences and then trying to capture that into the form of something useful for others as well. That all said, I can promise all of you but one thing by the end of our time together. I can promise you that my greatest learning has come from negotiating with three of the hardest bargainers that the world has ever seen, and you will have to believe me on this one. It is these guys, you know. These are my children, and I don't know how many of you have beautiful things that looks anything like this, but these are mine. Noah, Zachary, Liam, and you'll have to trust me, they are my greatest learning around how you negotiate the non-negotiable, you know. And I share this picture with you to simply once again reinforce that point that you are negotiating all the time. You are dealing with conflict in many different contexts, yes, at work, but also at home. So with that, let's jump into the big challenge. The big challenge for today, how should you deal with emotionally charged conflicts? Now, in the home context, it's obvious why you don't want negatively charged conflicts. It tears the family apart. It tears the relationship apart. You can't avoid conflict, but you can often avoid emotionally charged, divisive conflicts. In the work context, this stuff is costly. If typically on the financial spreadsheets at work, you have but one line that deals with conflict, litigation. And yet there are all of these hidden costs to conflict as well. I mean, if you seem like a nice enough gentleman, but I hate you. What's your name, sir?
Strawbridge.
Strawbridge? Okay, so Strawbridge, I'm Dan. And let's say we're working together and I despise you, you despise me, we are on a project team together. How good do you think our decision-making is going to be? Good or bad? Probably not that. How much information do you think Strawbridge is going to share with me? I'd imagine not much. And if it is, it might be even be a little deceptive and vice versa. How loyal will we be to one another? Probably not that loyal. How loyal to our outcomes? There are all of these hidden, implicit costs to conflict on the organization. You lose your star player. It takes you 2 years to find a replacement. That star player said, I just have had enough with this organization. Costs of conflict. And so the question is, how should you deal with conflict most effectively? And what we found is that the single most dangerous element of conflict, it's not about the behavior per se. It's not what you say per se. It's your mindset. And there's a mindset that I call, before even going there, let me go back one moment. This is how I think people typically conceive of the process of conflict resolution. We have a problem between us, Strawbridge and myself. There's a conflict. And let's just rationally float across those waters. Let's deal side by side with our differences. We'll get to that nice little island where we can celebrate our success. Conflict resolution. What's the problem with this picture? My sense, this is not what conflict typically feels like or what it looks like. It typically looks like this, you know? I mean, where the waves are pulling us one direction or another, the undercurrents, we can't even see them, pulling the two of us far away from one another. You have the headwinds, you have the tailwinds, and all of a sudden you think you're making such progress in your conflict, and then boom, back you go, you know, 50 kilometers, 50 years. This to me is the reality. And the question then is, what pulls us in all of these different divisive directions? It's this. It is what I call the tribes effect. So the tribes effect, it's a divisive mindset. You know, Strawbridge and I, we might be best friends at work or at home, but the second we get into an emotionally divisive conflict, the moment I feel that my identity is threatened, who I am, what I stand for, or you, all of a sudden, this thing tends to trip in, to come in. What are the three basic characteristics? I mean, just call to mind now. Call to mind a conflict from your own life, an emotionally charged conflict. And think about these three. One, the conflict starts to feel adversarial. Again, we might be best friends, but now the conflict is me versus you, us versus them. Point two, all of a sudden, my thinking is I am absolutely right and legitimate, and Strawbridge, you are absolutely wrong and crazy, you know? And point three, I will argue my perspective to death, defending it, and I am going to close my ears to your perspective. These are the three basic characteristics of this tribes effect mindset, this divisive mindset. And it is powerful. We are not immune to it. Nobody. Let me give you an example. I'll give it to you in brief. The first chapter of the book you have in your hands offers the details. How many of you have been to Switzerland? Okay, a number of you. How many of you have been to Davos, Switzerland, to the mountains of Switzerland? A number of years back, I was invited by a nonprofit organization called the World Economic Forum to do a little workshop there in those mountains of Switzerland in January for the annual summit of this World Economic Forum. Each January convene about 40 or 50 heads of state to the summit, the CEOs of the top 500 companies, civil society leaders, an amazing group of people with incredible portfolios of negotiation experience. I led for a group of about 48 or so people, led a small workshop in a closed room, no windows, which is called the tribes exercise. And in this room, they walk in, they stream in these 48 leaders, one by one. We had a deputy head of state in our room, CEOs from Fortune 50 companies, peace and security experts, just this very impressive group. As they walk in, they sit at six different tables. And I say to them, in the next 50 minutes, you have this wonderful opportunity at your tables to create your own tribes, to create your own group that you feel some identification with, true identification with. And I say, I have questions you'll need to answer. Here's some supplies. You want to dress up in your tribal garb. Gave them balloons, construction, you know, so literally I have a picture of this deputy head of state, balloon on his head, you know, wonderful blackmail that I will never use. But anyway, they spend about 50 minutes creating their own tribes. They come back to the middle, they come back to the room, and now you feel this energy in our room. Six very different tribes, different characteristics, different feel. I get up in front of the room, and in the most boring voice I can muster, I say, okay, let's debrief this exercise. And my sense is they're thinking, yeah, interesting exercise, but what's the point? You know? And all of a sudden, the lights go completely black in this room, completely dark. And into the room bursts this intergalactic alien. Huge head, bulging eyes. I am an intergalactic alien. I have come to destroy the Earth. I will give you one opportunity to save this world from complete destruction. You must choose one of these six tribes to be the tribe of all of you. You cannot change anything about your tribe or yours or yours or yours. And if you cannot come to agreement by the end of three rounds of negotiation, the world will be destroyed. You know, out floats this alien. And as ridiculous as this exercise sounds, these global leaders in the room realized we are global leaders. We will step up to this task. Round one, six chairs in the middle of the room. a representative from each tribe joins, no agreement. Fast forward, round two. Six chairs in the middle of the room, six representatives, one from each group, no agreement. Round three. These leaders now realize we have one final round to save the world from the aliens from the explosion. And it just so happens that as they come back into the room, to the middle of the circle, five men, one woman, as the representatives of their groups. And the moment they get back into the center of the room, these men start yelling over one another. They start yelling over this woman. This woman gets so rightly enraged, and I will never forget what happens next. She literally stands on her bar stool, which is what she was sitting on, stands on this thing and yells, "This is just another example of male competitive behavior. You all come to my tribe," you know. One tribe joins hers, the others refuse, and 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boom. Our world explodes at Davos. And I have run this exercise dozens and dozens and dozens of times now around the world for leadership across the continents, from the Middle East, Australia, the United States, at Harvard, at MIT, to mid-career executives, and with but the most modest exceptions, the world explodes again and again and again and again. In the course of only 50 minutes, we can allow people to create such an identity, one that they're so attached to, that they would rather explode the world than sacrifice that identity. Now think about the challenges that are facing our world today. How do we negotiate climate change? How do we negotiate international security and stability in the Middle East or here in the United States? How do you negotiate with ISIS or some of these other organizations, very identity bound? How do you negotiate with your fellow family member when you have a fundamental value-based difference? This is the challenge. And to me, the opportunity, the real problem in these conflicts, it's not about skills. Yes, it is about identity, but the opportunity is with the mindset. How can you transform moving away from that tribe's effect to a different mindset? The problem, however, is that there are all of these forces conspiring against us. And in negotiating the non-negotiable, I talk about five of those forces. And I call these things the five lures of the tribal mind. Five emotional forces that tend to pull us toward the tribe's effect, toward that divisive us versus them thinking and feeling. Vertigo, taboos, repetition compulsion, assault on the sacred, and identity politics. And I'm going to touch upon a few of these now. You can catch the rest in the book, but let's start with the first, vertigo. Think about that conflict that you were thinking about earlier, that difficult conflict between you and somebody else at work, at home. Vertigo, it's a concept I've been building. It is when you get so emotionally consumed in a conflict situation that you can think of nothing else but that conflict, but that evil other person who perpetrated that grievance against you. That is vertigo. And we all know it. The problem is that we often get into it without realizing it. Then we are stuck in this emotional tornado, you and me, both sides. You can't see outside those emotional walls. And you move toward the tribe's effect. Let me give you an example. A number of years back, I had this wonderful and very eccentric English professor. And he shared a story one day. He was in the mall with his wife, shopping for a bedspread. And he says his wife absolutely thought they needed this $500 bedspread. And he says, "I thought this was the stupidest financial decision we were ever going to make." And of course, what happens? They start getting into a conflict in the mall, arguing more. And he says, we started screaming at one another. And then he says, all of a sudden, for just a moment, my eyes averted those of my wife. He said, I saw there was a circle of onlookers watching us, and I had not noticed. And then he says, I looked down at my watch. 20 minutes had passed. I thought it was 5. This is vertigo. It is a warped state of consciousness where time and space, they don't disappear, but but they become convoluted. They become very different. And all of a sudden, the fact that 4 years ago on a Tuesday, you forgot to put down the toilet seat, that becomes fodder for our current conversation. There is, as one of my colleagues calls it, there's a time collapse. That evil past, that the feared and awful past, it becomes present. The feared future becomes the inevitable future. It is 100%, I cannot trust you, this will happen. And you see this in broad-scale, large-scale conflicts as well. 60 years ago, you did this, and it is as though it happened yesterday. And we are in this world of vertigo. Let me move on to this. How do you deal with these? It's in the book. I want to introduce you to most of them so you have some feel for what they are. Second, before we even go there, we're going to do a little exercise since this is early morning Philadelphia. So what I ask you to do now is if you could locate somebody, a single person, not single, like not married, a sole person, let me change it, find a partner, you know, and find, but somebody who you do not know, somebody sitting next to you or near you, okay? So find a partner, you want to sit next to that partner, be near that partner, and by the way, please, everybody, do this. If you do not do this exercise, I promise you, I will humiliate you. So, yeah. So find a partner, okay? Okay. Does anybody not have a partner? Anybody not have a partner? Okay, so suddenly this turned into social hour here in Philadelphia. Great. So thank you for doing that so quickly. We're going to do a little exercise now. The goal of this exercise is to help you get to better know this person or who you're partnered with. Okay? It might feel a little uncomfortable for some of you. That's okay. That's part of the learning process. So you're going to be sharing four things with this person who you're now partnered with. I ask you, do not start this exercise until I explain the exercise and say go, so that we all do it at the same time. So the four things that you're going to be sharing. Point number one, what's your salary? You know, what is your salary? Honestly, what's your salary? You know, so not what's the tax form say, but really what is this? Number two, with the political campaign utterly and, you know, propelling forward, what's your political leaning? So would you consider yourself a Democrat, a Republican, an independent, you know, or utterly sick of the whole thing, you know? What's your political leaning? Question number three. So these first two, you're sharing. So here's my salary, here's my political leaning. The next two, you're going to be taking your best guess about what it's like in terms of your perception of this other person. Number three, how attractive do you think your partner is? How attractive do you think they are? And just so that nobody walks away traumatized, let us assume that it's a scale from 1 to 10. A one isn't, you know, a one is more of you're okay, you know. So that's a one. And a 10 is you are just the hottie of Philadelphia, you know. So one, 10, whoa. So that's the deal there. How attractive do you think this other person truly is? And then finally, the fourth, how old do you think this person is? So what do you think is this other person's age? And the cool thing about this is that after the exercise is done, you get to discover if you were right or wrong, and in what direction. Were you too high? Were you too low? That's the exercise. So before we begin, just to make sure, any questions about this exercise? Any questions? Yes, sir.
Are we telling or asking?
So are you telling or asking? You are telling for the first two. And the second two, you're still telling, but it's your best guess of what you believe, how attractive you think this other person is, and what age you think they are. So it's all telling, but it's a different form of telling. Yes, a question over here? Sorry?
What is number three?
How attractive do you think the person sitting beside you is? Okay. Any other questions? You're ready to go. And number four, age. Age. How old are you? You know what? Here. Don't start yet. Don't start. Any other questions? Yes?
You want us to go back and forth, one question, one question?
Okay, so the question here, do you want us to go back and forth? It doesn't matter. Whatever process you would like. My son sat in on one of my lectures recently. He suggested you do rocks, paper, scissors to decide who goes first. That's up to you. So before we begin, any final questions? Any final questions? Yes?
Are we going to have an ongoing relationship with the person that we're talking to?
Are you going to... The question here is, are we going to have an ongoing relationship? Are you married? You feel free.
I don't mean that kind of relationship. Are we trying to not hurt the other person's feelings? Or are we trying to...
Are you trying not to hurt the other... Why would you hurt the other person's feelings? I won't ask. Okay. No, so how are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling a little anxious. I'm not really sure what my mindset should be going into the conversation. Am I trying to develop a rapport with the other person because we're going to have an ongoing, I don't mean relationship, interaction?
Yes.
Right?
So or the question is, what should my mindset be? Are we going to have an ongoing relationship, like a working relationship? Is this exercise going to have a second part to it that I should know about? If I say something offensive, that's going to screw me for later in this exercise. So, I mean, no, I can tell you factually, there's nothing beyond this. There's no other part to it beyond this. Any other questions? Yes?
Are you serious? Are you going to make us do this for real?
Why would I? Let me ask you, why not? Why not?
I'm waiting for you to
No, but why not? Why would I? Why not?
These are very difficult things to just...
Vertigo.
Start
vertigo.
Out there.
Okay. So they're very difficult things. Why are they difficult?
We already shared all this when we were getting to know each other.
Okay, so you already shared it. Okay. But why is this difficult for you?
They're very personal.
They're very personal.
Charged.
And they're charged. Mm-hmm. Okay. Politics charged today? Come on. And they're charged. And how are you feeling?
I'm hoping you're going to call it off.
You're hoping. I'm hoping you're going to call this off. That's not a feeling. What are you feeling?
Anxious.
Anxious. Yeah. So anxious. How many of you are feeling anxious on some level?
Yeah.
Well, without unduly traumatizing you further, my answer is no. We're not going to do this exercise. You know, no, we're not. Some of you are like, oh, I wanted to, you know. Yeah, no, and in fact, I recently, this exercise came to me literally last week, and I was doing this exercise in New York for a group of very established, lawyers, mediators from the New York area. Afterward, I said, oh, we're not going to do this, and they were like, oh, thank God. Meanwhile, afterwards, there's this reception. The drinks get going, and this one gentleman comes up to me with a French accent. I must just tell you, everybody is doing your little exercise, you know. And my sister, who's a lawyer, was there as well, and she walked away traumatized, you know. So anyway, why are we doing this exercise? My interest is not in traumatizing any of you. It's because of this. Taboos. Taboos are social prohibitions. They are, as my mother-in-law likes to put it, the big no-nos. The things you're not supposed to say, the things you're not supposed to do, the things you're not supposed to feel in the family or at the workplace. And the problem with taboos in terms of conflict is that these are often the elements that lie just dead center at the heart of our conflict situations. And yet we are scared to death to talk about them. And this makes for a huge problem. How do you negotiate difference with somebody else when the essence of the problem is something that you will get socially punished for if you do discuss? Don't talk about mom's drinking. You know that if you do, mom's going to explode. She might threaten to kill herself once again. And yet if you don't talk about it, she's drinking herself to death. Don't talk about the fact that dad always loved you more than me. You know, she's like, no, I don't think so. I was the one. and that's at the home at the work context, it's just as problematic. Don't give that boss the negative feedback. I promise you, if you want that promotion, she won't like it or he won't like it. Taboos. How do you deal with them? And again, just to fast forward so we can get through some more of these, this is an essential element. If you do not deal with taboos, you fall right toward that tribes effect. Me versus you, us versus them. And it's just as true, and I'll just show you the picture. In the book, I offer an example of some of the work I did in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, with Israeli, Palestinian, and international negotiators, looking there in that conflict. How do you deal with those issues that are utterly taboo to talk about? And yet, if you don't talk about them, you get the situation that we continue to see. People, it's not only issues you can't talk about. I can't even sit down next to you. It's a taboo to meet with the other side. How are we ever going to resolve these conflicts if we don't deal with the taboos? Third, the third, briefly, of these five lures is what Sigmund Freud originally called the repetition compulsion. My definition of it, it's a dysfunctional pattern of behavior that we tend to repeat again and again and again and again. You know, and you might go to a wonderful skills training on conflict resolution, something like that, send your employees, and they come back for the next 2 weeks, I am a transformed person. And you see the way they relate to people, it's different. It's more constructive, it's more collaborative for about 2 weeks, you know. And then all of a sudden, those really ingrained patterns start to seep back into their behavior. This is the repetition compulsion. And in relationships, this can be utterly challenging, because if you don't deal with this again, we get back into the same conflicts, whether spouses or colleagues at work, you get back into those same negative patterns of behavior again and again and again and again, whether it's the Middle East or it's our Congress here in the United States. It's problematic. It leads us towards this tribes effect, and we get stuck in a situation where we're losing value rather than gaining. That's the repetition compulsion. But let me close with the fourth of these five lures, which is what I call an assault on the sacred. The big idea here is there are many things we hold as sacred. Some, as I call it in the book, are sacred. There is no way I will ever sacrifice, perhaps on religion or on my love for my children. Some of they're sacred. But what I mean by sacred, just one word, sacred, anything that you hold deeply meaningful to you, to your identity, to what you stand for, to who you are, sacred. And the moment somebody comes along and attacks that which you believe is sacred, that's the moment you start spinning toward this tribes effect. And it could be, again, about religion, but it doesn't have to be. You spend months putting together a beautiful project design. You've put your heart, your soul in it. You haven't seen your kids over the weekend. You've been at work working on it. And then five months later, the boss comes into your office and says, boy, thanks so much for doing that. However, we, the senior management, have decided we're not going to move forward with it. On some small level there as well, it can feel like an assault on the sacred. Now you have the division within the organization. This is tough to deal with. And let me close with an example of how one might deal with this in even difficult circumstance. So part of the work I do is in advising hostage negotiators, crisis negotiators. So for example, worked with the New York Police Department's hostage negotiation team. Was privileged to be trained by them as well. Thought we might think through an example based upon a real-life situation. I was not involved in the actual situation. I learned about this through a training program. But I thought we might think about the situation together. It involves a gentleman who was about 26 years old, clearly suffering from schizophrenia, from delusions of grandeur. He thought he was better than God. And I should also make a side note, most people suffering from severe mental illness, such as schizophrenia, are actually less violent than the non-afflicted individual. What we see in the newspapers is it makes for the misconception, the stereotype of otherwise. But this gentleman was the exception. He had a violent tendency. And he was there in the subway system in New York City, just sort of wandering around. And as he's wandering around, he spots a woman about 20 years old carrying a baby in her arms. And he sees this woman. He runs up to the woman. He grabs the baby out of her arms. He pushes the woman into the train track, runs off into the janitor's closet, locks the door behind him. About 5 minutes later, the New York Police Department's hostage negotiation team, they arrive. And they hear behind this door, if this child is an angel, I will love this child to demon. You know what I have to do. If this child is an angel, love this child to demon. You know what I have to do. And bang, open up, open up, open up. We're banging on the other side of the door. And does our approach work? What do you think? Yes or no? Does our approach work? Yes or no?
No.
Of course not. Because what are we failing to do? What are we failing to do?
Appreciate it.
appreciate someone. This is the essence to effective negotiating in the most hostile or challenging conflict situations. Our tendency to interrogate, to fight for our side, to defend our own position. And boy, that does not work, especially in these kinds of tough situations. It only escalates the situation. And this gentleman now, if this child is an angel, love this child to David, you know what I have to do if the child, what are you going to say now, hostage? What are you going to say? If this child is an angel, I love this child to demon, you know what I have to do. And say it again.
Take care of the angel.
Take care of the angel of more. What would you say? If this child is an angel, I will love him. If this child is a demon, what are you going to say? What are you going to say? If this child is an angel, I love this child to demon. See, what would you say? Say it again.
He's an angel.
And say it one more time loudly so everybody can hear.
He's an angel.
This child is an angel. This child is an angel. And that is precisely what we said on this other side of the door. The child is an angel. And did it work? What do you think? Yes or no?
Yes,
yes or no?
Yes.
Of course, of course, of course. Not, you know. Unfortunately, because all of a sudden, this gentleman on the other side of the door... Angel, angel, angel. How do you know? How do you know? How do you know? How do you know this child is an angel? How do you know this child is an angel? I said there were three people on the other side of the door. How many people are really on the other side of the door? And all of a sudden, we have now made precisely the opposite error that we had made in this room 3 minutes ago. In the real life situation, undoubtedly several hours difference. At first, there's no appreciation, like you pointed out. At first, we're banging on the door like the stereotypic interrogator. You tell me what I need to know. You do what I tell you. That definitely did not work. And yet, but 3 minutes later, we are now way on this other side of appreciation. In a sense now, over-appreciating. Assuming we know more about what is going on in the mind of this hostage taker than he knows. And that is a dangerous place to be. I mean, just to break it down, make it real, I come home after a tough Friday at work, get home, and there my beautiful wife is at the door, and she opens up the door. I see she looks a bit tired, and she says to me, I have had the most frustrating day of my life with your three boys, you know? Now, if my response to my wife is, oh, honey, I know exactly how frustrated you are, I'm in trouble. You know, I am absolutely over-appreciating, assuming I know more about what is going on in her mind, her heart, than she knows. That was our situation here. We took a break and went back to the bare-bone basics, the essence of how you negotiate the non-negotiable, two easiest, two hardest things to do in the world in a conflict, listening and asking open-ended questions. Talk to us. What do you want? How can we help you? And once we started to ask those questions, we started to learn. We started to learn from this gentleman's perspective. He was not crazy. He was trying to save the world. Save the world from the demons. Bring in those sacred angels. And once we understood that, it completely changed our approach to the negotiation. Because now we could say, look, I'm NYPD. I don't see the angels you see. I don't see the demons you see. But I hear you saying you're trying to save the world. You know what? In our own small way here at NYPD, we're trying to save the world too. So why don't you open up that door and see if we can try and save this world together? Literally, 3 minutes later, that little door squeaks open, out walks that gentleman with baby in arms. But it is a challenge. When you are facing a situation that seems absolutely non-negotiable, how do you appreciate? How can you find it within yourself to appreciate the other side at that precise moment? That is your greatest source of power. So with that, let me put closure to our time together. The fifth of the lores, just so you think I'm not trying to hold something back. Identity politics, just watch the presidential debates. Just watch the situation. You'll get it. The notion, though, is that there are these five things. You know, we often say, oh, just work with your colleague, make things better, collaborate. That's useful. But if you don't deal with these underlying dynamics, often hidden, you're going to get sucked down here into this tribes effect, this mindset of us versus them, whether you are the leaders at Davos or the leaders here in Philadelphia. How do you deal with those lures? That's what the book is largely about. Then there's a whole other part on what I call a communal mindset. Sort of the positive side. So this morning we did the negative. But how do you build that good working relationship when there has been severe grievance, whether in the family or at work? And so you put it all together, big points to overcome an emotionally charged conflict, guard against that tribe's effect, that us versus them thinking, counter, try at least to counter those five lures. Watch out for vertigo. Don't go there. You know what your patterns are, your own repetition compulsions. Try to resist it if it's not working for you and for the relationship, and so on. And finally, as I suggest in the book, emphasize what I call the relentless we. Why does the world sometimes not explode? On rare occasion, you get a Mandela-like character who says, it's not about my tribe versus yours. It's we. It's not about Democrat versus Republican versus independent. We are a United States of America. It's about us. That's the essence. So with that, let me just say a huge thank you to all of you. It's an extreme honor to be here. By the way, I'm originally from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Used to come here for the amazing steak sandwiches on South Street. A tremendous honor. Thank you all so very much. Questions, comments, criticisms, whatever you... Yes, please. And then there's a microphone coming in your direction. It's above you with a lot of hair on it. Yes.
You work with these really difficult situations. Are you always successful?
No. So the question was, I work in a lot of difficult situations. Am I always successful? Absolutely not. You know, and I think the mistakes are where the great learning often happens. As an example, we used a lot of these kinds of ideas behind the scenes around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, working with some of the major parties on both sides, some of the major groups and leaders, to help them move toward breaking the impasse in the most, some 4 or 5 years ago. It helped. You know, there was a major effort that we did along with the World Economic Forum called Break the Impasse, bringing together business leaders in particular who said, look, conflict is not good for our business. And at the end of the day, it's not good for the people, of course, on a human level. And this had a substantial impact on ultimately the breaking of the impasse between the Israelis and Palestinians that led to the political negotiations that happened. That was the good part. The bad part, those negotiations failed. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Even in the home context, my wife would be the first to say, yeah, he tries his hardest to do this stuff, you know. But at the end of the day, we're all human. And I think that the challenge is how to become more aware of these lures so that, you know, all of us don't fall prey to them. Yeah, no, thank you for the question, though.
How do you deal with the situation where one side wants to listen and appreciate and the other side takes advantage? Witness the last 8 years of our national politics.
Yes. You start with the easy questions, don't you? I've stayed away from the U.S. politics. I think the Middle East is a bit more comfortable. Yes, you see a clear tribalism within the United States politics. I mean, it's a clear, clear tribalism. That tribe's effect is so ripe, you know, arguably on both sides to some greater or lesser degree. Each side, I don't want to work with them. And it's not necessarily even sometimes on the merit. It's simply the fact that you are group B and I am group A and we are not allowed to work with one another. It's taboo. I will be seen as a traitor if I even move toward you, if I'm caught talking to you on a video camera or a photograph. So is it possible to improve the situation in Washington? I think definitely. You know, I think there is a challenge of the intractable structures that are in place right now, the psychological structures of division. At the same time, there are amazing programs at the Harvard Kennedy School and elsewhere training both current and the next generation of leadership in these kinds of ideas. How can we negotiate more effectively? How do we, you know, because right now it's a lose-lose. Nobody's winning in this situation, arguably. How do you shift that mentality? I'm not sure I fully answered your question, though. Yes. He's like, no, you're right. Okay. Say it again? Oh, yeah, that's right. So what happens if one side is open to negotiating, is listening, doing all these kinds of things, and the other side isn't? There is absolutely power in one. There is power in one. Maybe it's difficult in the political scene in D.C. Nonetheless, one has more power than you think. In the book, I talk about something I and some other researchers call the space between. As you and I are negotiating, it's not just about you as a body and me as a body. There's this emotional space between us. And we know it in everyday language when we say, oh, there's something between the two of us, you know, and this is a problem. That's the space, and it only takes one to change that emotional dynamic. If you and I are in the midst of a conflict and you're absolutely not listening to me, and everybody's here looking at us, I might try and figure out, is there a way we can get a third-party mediator or facilitator to shift some communication between us? Might I say, look, after this whole program is done, let's you and I go out for coffee, just the two of us. We'll go to that private little cafe down the street. We can talk. I can do things to try and take action to improve the likelihood of two-way communication. In this hostage situation that I just demonstrated, one could argue, you're powerless. He has the child in his hands. Boy, he's not listening. That's everything but the truth. What's the core essence of conflict from an emotional perspective? There's an emotional stalemate. I desperately want to feel understood, heard, valued, appreciated. And so do you. And then there's the odd instinctual element at precisely that moment that we're each begging for the appreciation. Neither of us wants to give it. This means power. If one, just one, truly tries to listen and understand, you know what, say it says a Democrat, I want to sit down and really understand your perspective, Republican. I'm not going to try and change you. Or vice versa, Republican to Democrat, it may just open up the door a little bit more, for possibility. Is it the answer? No. So a second response to your question, as you and I are negotiating, I also want to think through what some of my colleagues call your BATNA, your best alternative to a negotiated agreement. If you and I can't come to an agreement, what's my walkaway alternative? What am I going to do? Because I don't want to be imprisoned or held hostage to you in this negotiation. I want to know what my alternatives are away from the table. Can I make them better? I'm trying to negotiate a business deal with you. You're not listening. You're becoming tougher and tougher. I might start talking to Pico over here and the COO and say, hey, you know what? I have some great products for the energy world. I'm still negotiating with you, but if you're a robot, you're absolutely not going to listen to me. I'm not going to walk away unemployed with my company falling down. I have a good alternative. So one, appreciate. Two, build that BATNA and consider walking if the other side truly is that robot.
Well, since you ended with religion, I wanted to know whether or not there was an ethical, moral, and or, dare I say, spiritual component to the way you devise the negotiating tools. I mean, are you driven by any of those pieces, the moral, spiritual, and or ethical?
I think so many in the field are, myself included. It's dangerous to become, a rabbi, a preacher, an imam. That's not my, I'm not trained in any of that. However, at the end of the day, I do think there's a transcendent element to, to the work that we're doing in this field. At the end of the day, what is it about? It is about trying to find that greater degree of interconnection between people. I think the greatest challenge to that deeper spiritual connection are all of these mental illusions that start to appear in our mind. You're completely, not just different, but dangerously different from me. And yet at the end of the day, on this core level, my senses were absolutely the same. And working across the continents, I remember my work in the Middle East and elsewhere. Initially, I walked in, how am I supposed to act? What am I supposed to do? Who am I supposed to be? And through this work, and I realized, you know what? We're all human beings. In the Middle East, in my work there in the Arab world and beyond, they care there as much about, I have a good relationship with their marital spouse as people do here. We can talk about how do you negotiate that. They care just as much about their organizational success. We're all human beings. So I personally think there's a huge spiritual component to the work I do. At the end of the day, though, the goal with these kinds of ideas, it's tactical. Practically, what are the tools that can allow you to execute that greater sense of interconnection in very divisive circumstances? Thank you for your question.
My children were your age, and my wife would get pushed against the wall. Her backup position was, I do not negotiate with terrorists.
Yes.
And so, so can you comment about when you should negotiate with terrorists, or how your context fits into those situations?
Yes. So I will not compare my children to terrorists, although they can feel that way. Absolutely. So how do you negotiate with terrorists? It's a critical question. On the one hand, I think some things are, you know, negotiation isn't the answer to everything. You know, God forbid someone walks in this room right now with a gun and just starts shooting. I wouldn't advise people at that precise moment in time to try and talk to that person. I'd say run or let's storm that person. That's one side. Secondly, though, how do you negotiate with Al-Qaeda or ISIS? Many people wrongly assume, I think wrongly, oh, they're just irrational. They're utterly crazy. They have no clear motivation to what they're doing. It's just not true. You know, they are absolutely driven sometimes by the sacred. I feel like my sacred world is being assaulted by yours. That's good to know. The more I can understand the mentality, the mindset of that potential terrorist, the more I can try and influence them. Two, people say, oh, you can't communicate with them. Boy, they are wonderful communicators. I mean, think about the internet communication plans of a group like ISIS right now. To me, that's an opportunity. We can have back and forth negotiation between communications. Three, in the book, I talk, and this is going more theoretical, but I talk about the notion that we all see the world from our own sphere of identity. Some people, for example, see the world from a completely, what I call a quantumist approach. Yes, I'm somewhat of a constructed person. I can change as a human being to some degree, but there's some biological given. And then there are others of us in this world who are more in the fundamentalist realm. I am divinely myself. My beliefs are divine. There is nothing about myself that can ever be changed. I am a product of a god or gods. How do you negotiate with that person? In the book, I share an example of a conversation I had with a very eminent lawyer. And this lawyer many years back had this unusual opportunity to talk with a suicide bomber, a kid basically, from the Middle East, before he went off and did his thing. And the question was, what should he say in that conversation with the goal of trying to persuade this child, this teenager, out of this activity? And his idea was, I'm going to tell this child, look, you're 14 years old. You have your whole life ahead of you. You explode yourself, you kill a few people, you might be in the papers for a day, you might call attention to your political cause, but at what cost to you, to others, and at what potential that you've lost? Think of what you could do economically, politically, and so on. As I was listening, though, to this idea, what struck me was, boy, this is rational. And as I'm sitting there as the 14-year-old, indoctrinated into a certain belief system, who is this Western rational lawyer telling me I have the rest of... I don't care about that. I care about the sacred, infinite life ahead of me. So how do you negotiate with that kind of person? And my sense is that one still can negotiate. Another way to try and negotiate is to look, who are the gatekeepers? Who are the religious figures or others who that 14-year-old will listen to? And can you try to work with them on their interpretations of their religious text or something like that? Shifting the taboo line in terms of what is acceptable in terms of violence for political reason. So it's another way to try and deal with this, you know. And more generally to your question, I think there's a huge need in our societies at large to think about where is the taboo line in terms of violence. You know, I every day, I have those three cute kids, every day when they go to school, honestly, I get scared to death. You know, I love you is a deep I love you, with the rare but plausible situations of the school shootings, things like that, the taboo line in terms of violence, I think, has shifted much too far in the wrong direction. We, as a, you know, as a country and as a globe, have the possibility to shift that as well, just as much as working to shift it with these terrorist organizations as well. Thank you. It's been an honor. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.